Welcome to Maritime Noon. I'm Norma Lee McLeod. Fishermen protest in southwest Nova Scotia claiming native fishermen are poaching and selling lobster intended for a food fishery.
There's no one regulating them to see how many traps they get out. There's no one regulating the pounds that they're bringing in.
An Indigenous leader responds saying native fishermen have the right to sell their lobster catch.
If our people are fishing, exercising their right to a moderate livelihood, and they're catching lobster and selling lobster, there's no laws being broken.
And is there such a thing as a good firing?
Hello, Mr. Trump. I was wondering what you would say to President Obama.
You're fired.
That stark, bold approach gets the job done, but what's it like when you're on the other side of the table? Tell us your firing story. This is Maritime Noon. Time to talk. Lobster fishermen are protesting at several DFO offices in southwestern Nova Scotia today, demanding the department enforce the rules around the native lobster fishery. The fishermen say there's been poaching going on all summer. They say native fishermen who are allowed to fish out of season for a food fishery are setting more traps than they're allowed and selling their catch. They're concerned that lobster grounds will be fished out by the time their season begins later this fall. We spoke to a number of fishermen this morning who wanted to tell their story but didn't want their names broadcast for fear of retaliation. The CBC has agreed to give this fisherman from Digby Neck anonymity. Here's my conversation recorded earlier this morning. What's been happening this summer that's led to these protests?
Well, the natives have had a right for a food fishery. They've had it for many years. But this summer, there's been no one checking them, no surveillance from our government, and it's got into, there's not just four or five boats out doing their food fishery, there's 23 boats in our little area doing it, right where we got to try to do a commercial fishery after they clean it up, and there's no one regulating them to see how many traps they get out, there's no one regulating the pounds that they're bringing in. You know, if it's a food fishery, they're only supposed to have like 60 lobsters in the possession, and these guys are coming in with 2,000 pound a day right now.
What's happening to the lobster?
Then they're getting sold to other people are buying them. I'm not going to get into that and say no names, but they're getting sold for cash, and someone else is buying them, and then the meat's going somewhere else for cash, and it's just going down the line that way.
We had a statement from the Indian Brook First Nation, which says all the lobsters from their vessel have been going from the ocean to our dinner tables. And they say that the lobster caught through this fishing has been distributed to community members for community feasts and donated to other communities for their feasts. Do you believe that to be true?
No. Well, this organization here now is going to take over £1 million out of our water. So we, you know, go through the green cards. There should be shells there. You know, they're not eating them. They're just, it's the chiefs aren't even seeing them. They're just, there's some renegades down here and they're selling them, putting all the money in their pocket. And the bands, the peoples on the reserves aren't even seeing these lobsters eat.
How do you know this?
Oh, I know it because we see where they're going, but we're not going to point to tell you where they're going. That's up to the government to work that problem out. But go to the reserves and ask the people on the reserve, the Indian Brooks, how many lobsters they've ate this summer.
This is a
That's why you guys should be doing the story. You know, we're just fishermen trying to protect our livelihood, and the government has failed us in not doing their jobs. And they're still trying to make the poor fishermen look bad because we're just trying to stick up for what little bit of rights we got left. And, you know, this is a $8 million poaching season, whatever you want to call this food fishery, because they're not eating them. We know it. We see it. They can't eat that many.
How does this affect you as an individual fisherman? I mean, there's a huge fishery along your shore.
I can tell you, when I leave the wharf on the last Monday in November, I have two lobster licenses on my boat, and I fish the same waters where they are fishing right now. So if I set my 563 traps that I've worked 25 years to establish in my life, on bottom, there's no lobsters in them. And our fall season, the first 2 weeks of every season, is half your summer's work or half your year's work. So if we don't set on lobsters, they're empty. We got to get down on someone else's bottom that wasn't fished all summer. So then we got fishermen fighting amongst fishermen because you're down here trying to get our lobsters now. So that's putting the fishermen fighting each other. And it's just that's what's going down. It's putting us fighting ourselves, trying to make a living. When the government's letting this food fishery take our living from us, you know, we're fine with them having a food fishery if they regulate them to what they're supposed to have. But the bay's full of untagged gear, and they're not eating them. I wish someone would do a story on that and go through these bans and ask the locals that live in the villages of these reserves and ask them how many lobsters they actually get to eat a year. And you'll find that none of them see any more than four or five lobsters if they've seen that many a year.
You and other fishermen are protesting but don't want your names in the media. Why not? What are you afraid of?
Why not? Well, I'm going to explain, okay? If I was a fisherman, I'm a known person here. I fish the same waters. The people buying them probably would know me. So what's to say, okay, this bastard just took $1 million out of our pocket that we could have made this summer cast. Let's go burn him out. Let's go, you know, they know where I live. They know where my boat is. They know where my freezers are. And they could trap my family, and I don't, who wants to live with that much pressure on your back thinking that you could lose everything you just worked 25 years for some, you know, illegal activity that's going on?
That's quite an accusation that you think someone's going to burn you out.
I'm going to say that the accusations have already been thrown out. How's that? That's why I'm covering my name, and if that's why I'm not giving permission for my name. It's already happened.
What's the solution here?
The solution is for the Department of Fisheries, Ocean, and the Government of Canada to enforce their own laws. We recognize there's a food fishery, we're fine with it, but they're allowed 3 traps, 60 lobsters a day. Enforce it. Be on the water. Check to see how many lobster traps are out there. Make sure they're meeting the requirements. Make sure they actually are the native that has the right to fish. There's just, I don't know what's going on with Ottawa, because they must be trying to work with the natives, because they're not, they're scared to even try to charge one to take to court, because the judges just keep throwing everything out. They have the right to do it, but there's no one enforcing the law, you know, the laws that to keep them within the boundaries that they were allowed to fish.
All right. I'm going to leave our conversation there. Thank you for talking to us today.
Okay.
Bye-bye. That's a fisherman from Digby Neck, Nova Scotia. The CBC has agreed not to use his name. Well, I'm joined now by Mike Sack. He's the chief of the Sagabagani First Nation. Their vessel, the Treaty Defender, is involved in the native fishery. Hello to you.
Hello.
I spoke to a number of fishermen this morning who say that native fishermen have been fishing illegally this summer, selling their catch rather than using it as a food fishery. What do you say to that?
I think it's false pretenses. I'm not sure of everyone's situation, but I know some people are food fishing. Maybe some people are exercising their inherent right to a moderate livelihood.
If you say that some people are exercising their right to a moderate livelihood, that's not what's agreed to under the food fishery, is it?
There's multiple agreements.
Can you explain what you mean?
It's up to that particular person which route they take to fish. So some might be food, social, ceremonial, under the sparrow. Some might be exercising their treaty right to a moderate livelihood,
now,
which there is no season. So we're not fishing out of season, so nobody's doing anything wrong.
Now, fishermen believe that the only right that is granted by these licenses is the right to a food fishery. Do you see it otherwise?
Yes, I do. We have a right to fish what we want, when we want, and that sums it up.
And you think that includes lobster?
Any species.
Has this been tested in court?
I believe that's what the Marshall decision would have been.
So if fishermen are fishing lobster and selling their catch, you believe that this is not breaking the law?
I don't believe any laws have been broken. I haven't seen any evidence that any laws have been broken.
But
if our people are going to fish and exercise their right to a moderate livelihood, I support that 100%.
This goes beyond what the understanding was of the food fishery, doesn't it?
The food fishery is separate. It's something for an opportunity to bring lobsters home to the community for events or feasts or gatherings.
Are fishermen keeping records of the lobster that are sold?
I'm not even sure people are selling them. That's just speculation brought about by the local fishermen in the area.
You said that some of them are exercising their right to a moderate livelihood. That sounds like...
I said some may be exercising their right, but I haven't had it confirmed or I haven't seen anyone's catch records. I don't think I'm privy to that information.
And if they are selling them, you think that there's no law being broken?
If our people are fishing, exercising their right to a moderate livelihood, and they're catching lobster and selling lobster, there's no laws being broken.
There have been a number of protests on several wharves in southwestern Nova Scotia over a number of weeks, and there are protests today at DFO offices asking DFO to enforce the rules of the food fishery. What do you think of those protests?
I wouldn't call them protests. It's kind of intimidation tactics, kind of mob gatherings. Protests are done during the day with media present. These are just hundreds of fishermen gathering at wharves trying to scare people off.
And you that's been happening?
Yes, it has.
What message do you think these groups are trying to send to native fishermen?
I'm not sure the message they're trying to send.
Are fishermen intimidated?
They certainly are.
In what way? What have you heard?
That there's hundreds of angry people threatening, making threats, trying to sink their boats.
Somebody has tried to sink a boat?
Yeah, there's been attempts for them to cut the guy's electrical system so the pumps won't pump out and try to sink a boat.
Where do you think this is headed, Chief Sack?
I hope it's headed down the right road and that it'll be resolved quickly and that the local non-native fishermen will educate themselves and respect what we have going for us.
You're hoping they'll just let you fish?
I don't hope they'll let us fish. I hope they go about doing their business and leave us alone to take care of ours.
One fisherman I spoke to this morning felt that this was getting very heated and wanted to talk about it, but was afraid to use his name because he felt that he was being threatened. Do you think that's what's going on?
There's a lot of keyboard warriors, I guess they're called, and talking big and making threats over social media.
Who's threatening whom?
I haven't seen all of the... I just been told what's going on, and it seemed to me that there's been a lot of... I'm very proud of our people. They've been taking it the high road, not interfering or not engaging in any wrongdoings. They're just trying to fish. That's all they're trying to do.
Well, Chief Sack, thank you for taking our call today.
No problem.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Chief Mike Sack from the Sebaga Negati First Nation. Now, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans doesn't agree with Chief Sack's position. Here's Area Director David Worley speaking about the Food, Social and Ceremonial Fishery, the FSC.
There is not a right to the sale of FSC caught fish. It's contrary to regulation to sell, buy, trade, barter FSC caught fish without special permission from the minister, and that special approval hasn't been issued. So yes, we've heard the complaints around illegal sale as well.
That's David Worley, the Area Director for Fisheries and Oceans Canada. He also says it's illegal to buy this fish. Now, we want to hear from you. Do you believe that Indigenous fishermen have the right to fish lobster for a modest living? Where do you think this dispute is heading? Leave us a message. Our answering machine is at 1-800-565-5463. Our email here is marnoon@cbc.ca, and you can tweet me at CBC Maritime Noon.
You're listening to Maritime Noon on CBC Radio 1, 94.3 FM in Glencoe Mills, Cape Breton.
Thanks for joining us. It's now 19 minutes past 12. Late in August, the Globe and Mail decided to trim its roster of columnists. The paper's making changes. It's combining sections and cutting its print edition in the Maritimes. So it's not a huge surprise that it meant letting some people go. But one columnist who had been writing for the paper for 17 years took issue with how she got the news. Leah McLaren got an email along with a number of her colleagues. The wording of each email was exactly the same. In essence, it was firing by form letter. Well, McLaren shot back with a snappy, sarcastic email of her own where she reviews her firing. She describes the email firing as inexcusable management style, appalling jargon-filled memo speak, and a complete lack of human empathy. She calls it How Not to Fire Someone. If you're interested, we've posted more on this on our Facebook page. But today we want to hear from you. Is there such a thing as a good firing? We want to hear how you got the news and how you reacted. Is there something that employers or employees can learn from your story? Our lines are open now. Give us a call. 1-800-565-1940 is the toll-free number. You can also send an email here. That's marnoon@cbc.ca. Tell us your firing story. Our guest today is Jerry Walsh. He is the founder of Gerald Walsh Associates. His company handles executive searches and career coaching, and as part of his work, he coaches employers on how to fire employees. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Normally.
I suspect no matter how tough you are, firing is a difficult thing to do. Is that your experience, that most people you coach find this a tough job?
Oh, absolutely. Very few employers take this lightly. In fact, it's, you know, it's a very serious process to sort of make the decision to have to dismiss an individual or group of individuals, for sure, and then to ensure they do it in a compassionate way.
What do you think about the firing by email and an employee getting an identical email to all of the other people who are being let go?
Yeah, that would be one. I was actually shocked when I read that, and to me, it's one of the worst ways to possibly dismiss somebody. Now, I don't really know the circumstances of those particular reporters. It sounds like they were freelancers and on a contract basis, so you'd have to look at the terms of their of their agreement with the Globe and Mail. But I have heard people, in full-time employees, being dismissed by email or being dismissed as a group. Like, to me, it's one of those really important discussions that an employer has to have with an employee, and that's typically done on a one-on-one basis, face-to-face, if at all possible.
So is it just being evasive, do you think, by shooting off an email?
It's certainly being evasive. It's certainly lacking empathy, totally. And it's like no thought went into that process. I can imagine if that person thought about it for a minute, he would have realized that this is not an appropriate way to do this.
And what do you think of Leah McLaren's response, which she, you know, made public in some way because it was reported by the media? Do you think that was a good idea or not, to kind of snap back?
It's hard to put myself into her shoes exactly. You know, the range of emotions that people go through when they are dismissed, and will vary. Some are very angry. Some will disagree with the decision, of course, and want to try to reverse it. But typically the best response is to not respond that way in anger. But as I said, I was surprised by her immediate response. You can sort of see her emotion coming through on that. I suspect, I don't know what the timing was between her receipt of the email and her response. My suspicion is that it was a short period of time, and it was a very impulsive response, which typically is not a good way to do it.
Do you think that's damaging in some way if you respond in kind to a poor firing?
Definitely damaging to your career as well.
Okay, yeah. Making a bad situation worse. But it's tempting. I mean, you want people to know that this is not how I want to be treated as an employee.
It's one of the hard things for an employee to do, someone who's been dismissed, to actually come over time to some level of acceptance to this, because, you know, the immediate reactions, people are concerned about their own welfare, their family, if they're being dismissed. They're concerned about monetary reasons. They're concerned about their own careers and what impact it might have on that. And many will disagree with that decision and just disagree with it totally. But, you know, my view is that there's always a shared responsibility. And once an individual goes through those ranges of emotion, it's important to sort of sit down and kind of reflect about how they may have contributed to that breakdown in that working relationship. And I'm sure in most cases there's at least a part of it caused by the employee.
All right. And in your experience, is the firing usually a bolt from the blue, or can most employees see it coming?
Well, employers will fire for one of two reasons, one of which is financial. You know, a company has to downsize, or they've merged, or they've lost a major client. And so employees will typically see that and start to worry about the trend of hiring or dismissals in the workplace. So that's anticipated. Sometimes the other main reason is for performance reasons, which is harder for the individual to take. I think a person would have to have very low self-awareness to not recognize that they themselves are probably underperforming in many cases. And if an employer does their job well, of course, they will have actually have spoken to that individual prior to the dismissal and periods of time and just given them an opportunity. My experience is that employers actually really obviously don't want to do this and are hoping the situation will reverse and will try to coach the individual around performance improvement, hoping that it will change, but in the end have to make the decision. So probably it's not out of the blue in most cases.
Okay. All right. We're asking our audience to join in today. Tell us if you think there is such a thing as a good firing. What happened to you? 1-800-565-1940 is our toll-free number. John Solos is calling us from Yarmouth. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for the call today. Have you been fired in the past?
I worked in development projects overseas for years, and they tended to be sunrise, sunset, and pretty well always, well, my contract was terminated when my services were no longer needed. There was one contract where they ran out of money about 6 months early and said, well, okay, basically I was finished 6 months earlier than was initially anticipated. That was okay. It was getting late in the project, and folks there could manage without me, so it worked out okay. Sometimes I felt I was getting in the way of direct communication between people in the country and people outside that needed to sort of collide themselves.
Yeah. So did you, when you were, it was unexpected, but it was kind of a financial reason for you being let go.
Yeah, and it wasn't a complete shock either. Like, I mean, I was seeing myself. I think I've done what I can do. I was there, I'd been there 5.5 years, and really, the people in the country were capable of running things themselves, and there were some communications issues, but looking back on it now, I think I was getting in more in the way of that by trying to keep other people from hurting each other.
Yeah, but how did they treat you when you were fired? Were you treated compassionately?
Yeah, they were a little bit apologetic about it, and I said, "Don't worry, I understand."
Well, you took it as best you could, I guess.
Well, it was time.
All right, John, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right. Is it easier to get that news, though, if it's for financial reasons? If it's for performance reasons, then you have to kind of look at yourself and figure, what am I doing wrong, which is tough. But if it's companies out of money or downsizing, is that different?
Sure. One of the key things that individuals who've been dismissed think about fairly early is, what are they going to say in their interviews as they look for another job?
Right.
And how will that impact their, you know, their employability? So if someone's been fired because their company downsized for financial reasons, so it's, you know, but there's no issues around performance. So
most of us call that a layoff anyway,
a
as
layoff,
opposed
for sure.
to a firing.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
exactly. So so that one's easily explained. If it's for performance reasons, it's definitely more challenging. But I recommend in an interview, it's going to come up. An employer will typically ask, why did you leave, you know, job A to, you know, why aren't you still employed there? But my point of view is kind of deal with it quickly, deal with it. Don't have long scripted answers. You don't want to make it more than what it really is. And, you know, frankly, performance personality disagreements and conflicts happen all the time in the workplace. And if it's, for example, if you have a disagreement with your boss, a conflict, that's not that unusual these days. And I think people are still worried about the stigma of looking for a job when they're unemployed. But people have been fired a lot these days. So, you know, as a recruiter myself, someone who's involved in a lot of hiring, if I've heard someone's left a company, they've been laid off or dismissed, whatever, it's not that big a deal anymore. So I think people also tend to make more of an issue out of it perhaps than they should.
So somewhere along the line, the stigma of being fired has changed, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people that have gone through, you know, been unemployed for whatever reasons now. And so it's not that big a concern anymore. But I've seen occasionally job candidates in interviews make more of an issue out of it and becomes more of a red flag. So I would just say, have a good explanation, have it sort of well rehearsed what you're going to say. Don't lie. Just tell the truth. Explain what happened and just move on.
Okay. Kim is next, calling us from the Miramichi. Hi. Thanks for the call today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right. I'm asking people how their firings went. Do you think you had a good firing or not?
Heavens, no. No, I just I found out last Friday that I got fired by email. They sent a text first that there was an email to follow, and I checked my email, and sure enough, I was fired.
So a little bit of a text warning, and that's it.
Oh, that was it. But, I mean, if you can text my phone, you can call my phone.
Right. So how did you feel when you got that email? What did it make you feel like as an employee who's been fired this way?
I was absolutely dumbfounded and mortified.
What would you have preferred? What would have made a difference to you?
Well, to not have been fired, because it certainly wasn't a performance issue. I'm a personal support worker who had worked 24 and 25 days in a row.
Yeah, so it was the firing itself. Now, if it was going to happen anyway, you wanted something face-to-face, I gather, then, not the email.
Well, right, and a chance to explain the situation, but, I mean, they knew the situation.
All right, well, Kim, thanks. There's some good points that you make there that you often hear. So Jerry, is it time, when you're firing someone, do you encourage employers to have a conversation on that day about what went wrong?
So in the case of Kim, I don't think she explained or answered whether or not the employer explained why she was dismissed. So that's often frustrating, because lots of times employers have the right to dismiss individuals. So really what you're all you're talking about then is money and severance. And many, many times they don't actually give a reason for the dismissal, mostly because they don't want to get drawn into an argument with the individual. The individual's going to disagree.
So they avoid it.
They avoid it. So say the reason is the person's disruptive in the office. They're not a good communicator and don't get along with other employees. It's a difficult issue to bring up. So and naturally, the person's probably going to disagree with them. So they tend to avoid it. What happens typically in a dismissal is that there's an offer of severance, which is open for 7 or 10 days to accept. It's usually about money, how long they're going to pay their wage and our benefits coverage during that period of time. And once that's signed off, sometimes employers will sit down with you and go through it. But in that interim period, typically there's little communication between the employer and the person who's been dismissed.
All right. Our number here is 1-800-565-1940. Tell us if you think there's such a thing as a good firing. And if it's happened to you, was it a cold experience or was there compassion? That's 1-800-565-1940. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. First, Ryan Pierce is in with a news update. Hello, Ryan.
Hi, Normalee. Good afternoon. DFO says it is taking action after complaints from commercial lobster fishermen on Nova Scotia's South Shore that there's too much poaching going on. Some of their ire is directed at Indigenous harvesters whose leaders say they have every right to not only catch lobster year-round, but sell some of it too. A 17-year-old has drowned in New Brunswick after falling at a waterfall site near Moulin Morneau, and a Cape Breton woman is due in court today accused of leaving her dog in a car with no water or food for so long that the dog died. More on those stories at 1 o'clock, normally.
All right, thank you, Ryan. Once again, Jerry Walsh is my guest. He's the founder of the executive search company Gerald Walsh Associates. And we're asking today, is there such a thing as a good firing? Tell us how your firing was handled. Was it as good as can be expected, or was it bad? That's 1-800-565-1940. Just before our next caller, when you talk about reasons for firing, is there sometimes a quote-unquote real reason and then a reason you tell the employee, or is this 100% honesty most of the time?
I wish it was honest all the time, because I personally believe one of the big failings of the workplace is the failure to tell the truth to each other. And sometimes people beat around the bush a little bit in terms of the real truth. So subject to the kind of the possible liability, sometimes it's liability or potential liability that holds employers back from actually explaining something to an individual. But I know when I've met with individuals after the fact, that is one of the most frustrating parts. I mean, people are bothered for months, perhaps even longer, about not understanding why they were dismissed. And it's very, very frustrating for them. They can't quite get over that. And I don't have a good answer to that one. If everybody could tell the truth, life would be a whole lot better, for sure.
And that would be your advice? That would
be my for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. Thelma's in the Annapolis Valley to join us. Hi, Thelma.
Hi.
Hi. Is there such a thing as a good firing? What was your experience?
Well, my experience was not a good one. I had a call to the manager's office expecting a review. I was an occupational health nurse, had been with the company for nearly 5 years, and my review before was when I asked what was expected when they had given me a raise. He said, all our expectations have been met, and shook my hand across the desk.
And then the next time you went in?
And so the next time I went in, he said, we would be pleased if you would look for another position.
So,
and I said, are you terminating me? And he said, we would like you to obtain another position, and gave me 2 weeks' notice, which was terrible because I was 60 years old at the time, and I couldn't believe that this was happening after having had such good reviews for the past 4 years.
Well, let me bring Jerry in on that. That sometimes if there is a good review and then all of a sudden this happens, which is what happened to Thelma, what's going on in a situation like that? Should she have had a little more information leading into that review meeting?
So I can understand Thelma's upset at that point in time and perhaps not being able to think clearly and on the spot, but Thelma, did the employer actually give you a reason why he was dismissing you?
He did not, but I found out later it was because the company was being moved to Mexico, and they didn't want the employees to know that the company was being moved, and so they were terminating as many as they could. A lot of people were part-time people, and the part-time work was terminating, and
So you kind of get caught up in that, for sure.
So that would be for financial reasons, and it's that particular instance, the employer had some reasons for keeping it confidential. Hopefully they would have treated you with an appropriate severance package.
They offered me two weeks severance. They did not give me time to properly close files or anything like that. No, it was a very bad situation.
Well, so what is an employer obligated to do if you're being fired? Is it different for every company what severance must be offered?
Well, the minimum level is determined by the Labor Standards Code, and every particular province has a standards code, and it will depend on your years of service and so on. There are some guidelines that are followed for more senior level positions, one of which is a month per year of service. That's more in what's called common law. But I would, if you're more senior, if you've been with an employer for a long period of time, say 15 or 20 years, the amount of severance that you would typically be offered could be fairly significant. So what I would do, if I would Thelma or any of the other individuals that are out there that are facing dismissal, is take that offer of severance, have it reviewed quickly by an employment lawyer to see if it's reasonable or not, and you may be able to negotiate a little bit more as a result of that review and going back and forth a little bit. But
that could soften it a bit, at least.
Money will. And there are other components besides money, too. So sometimes employers offer career coaching or career transition services to help individuals with resume preparation and job search strategy themselves. Sometimes this severance amount can be spread over, say, 10 months or something like that, in which case you will stay on the benefits plan of the company as if you're an employee. So there are ways of softening that blow somewhat.
Tougher if the company's kind of slipping out of the country,
no, for
I guess.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, Thelma, thank you for that story. Martin Root is in Disable PEI. Hi, Martin. How are you doing?
Hi, Normally. Hi.
Hi. So you wanted to share a story of a firing. What happened?
This is a friend of mine years ago, Robert, we met. He was, at the time, I don't know if he still is, head of a Tomasso Corporation. And he had this policy that if a manager or he had to fire somebody, whether it was reduced, that didn't work out right, they weren't doing their job, or the business was going on a down curve, he would have the manager call the employee 6 months later, 6 months after they were let go, to find out how they were doing and to see if there was any other support the company could provide to the employee. I thought that was one of the most amazing things I'd ever heard about how to let somebody go with real class and ethics and just way beyond the line. I thought it was a beautiful story.
Yeah, it is. Now, I wonder what if the person was really struggling 6 months on, how you would deal with that. But, I mean,
he would offer support. Now, obviously, not every employee, some employees said, thank you for calling, I'm fine, it was the best thing that happened, or I'm struggling, and, I would like some support, and they might offer career counseling. I don't know exactly what he would do. But it was the offer that, we still want to look after you. That was amazing to me.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. So, Jerry, that sounds like in all the best of circumstances, that's a good firing, I guess.
Yeah, what Martin describes, Martin's a good friend of mine and a neighbor in PEI. That's pretty rare, what Martin's describing. If only companies could be that compassionate and that empathetic. What I find, unfortunately, is once somebody's dismissed, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And there's very little communication that happens. So if the example that Martin gives of that employer, boy, if everybody could behave that way, life would be a lot better.
It's tough, too, because if you're fired, sometimes you're completely cut off, from all these people you worked with. Mm-hmm. I've heard people almost say they feel like a pariah, that there's contagion around you, that if they associate with you, that somehow they're at risk. Do you hear that?
Well, one of the stories that I remember a lot, there was a person I know, his name was Chris, was the director of finance at one of our local hospitals in the course of the various amalgamations, and he was dismissed, and he told me afterwards the worst thing for him was actually being escorted by two security guards down a long hallway out the door, that right after the dismissal, and having to wave goodbye to his work colleagues that he worked with for 10 or 15 years and never to hear from them again. So it is unfortunate, though that particular act was very, very disturbing naturally for Chris, but also the People build up their friendships in many cases around their coworkers. And yes, once you're cut off, it's sometimes harder to maintain those relationships. So people certainly miss that element of their life.
Why do people march people down a hall while their colleagues are sitting at their desks? Is there not a better time and place to fire someone?
Yeah, there's almost no good way to do this. What we would recommend, we're coaching employers to do it. We ask them to think about the time, a lot about the logistics of the dismissal in the office. And so time of day, usually I would recommend like mid to late afternoon. Sometimes some other workers have gone home at that point in time, usually not on a Friday, because sometimes people are gone for the week. You don't know what their family situation is, or there's anybody to kind of support them when they go home. And that's really challenging. From the employer's point of view, I think their rationale behind it principally is that if the person stays on after they've been dismissed, they'll be somewhat of a drag on other employees that are still there. They'll bring morale down. Potentially, they're going to steal some files and all that. Like, that almost never happens, but that's the way some employers think.
Okay, let's go to Dan Cox in Miramichi, New Brunswick. Hi, Dan. How are you?
Well, how are you?
Good, thanks. Okay, what is your experience? Is there such a thing as a good firing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a good way and a bad way to handle it. Obviously, being escorted down a long hallway, I've seen that before. It's never nice, but I've had two different experiences, but I'll talk about the good one. I worked in the law firm shortly after I got laid off from a federal government job. So I took the first thing that came along, and it was not a good fit. And a couple months in, I was sat down, very compassionately, and it was one of the managing directors and then the lawyer that I worked under, and they basically told me, we don't think this is working, and we can see that you're not into it either. And it was very mutual. It was very good, and honestly, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Well, did you have kind of a sense of relief maybe then? Because you probably didn't want to quit the job after having lost another one.
No, absolutely not. And I had never been on employment. And, I was very lucky. I'd never been on EI before, so I got education into that. But it was just interesting, the fact that that they sat me down and it forced everybody in the office on both sides of the table to take a good hard look at what was working and what wasn't, and they had an exit interview as well. In the sense of, what was working, what could we do better for maybe the next person.
Now, you say it was the best thing that ever happened to you. How so?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it forced me. I ended up getting employment counseling through a provincial initiative, and they taught me how to market myself. They asked what, I had found a mentor through that, and they said, what guy are you? Are you a numbers guy? Are you a people guy? Are you a computer guy? And I said, well, I got this job, this government job at a university, and then I got the legal job, and I didn't really know. So I ended up finding the answer to that. So,
and that set you into a job that it's a good fit now, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was the reconciliation part that I hadn't really, some people don't have a chance to do that. And once you get a kick in the teeth like that, you say, well, I need to get smart about this. And there's resources out there for people that might not have that answer for themselves.
Well, it's good to hear your story. It worked out well.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, swallowing my pride and getting help from the province and getting help from resources that I didn't even know that were out there was literally one of the best things that I ever did. And anybody that I know that gets laid off, I tell them, go seek these resources out. They're invaluable in a job search and branding yourself for a career, not just a job, right?
All right. Well, Dan, thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. Have a good day.
Thanks. Now, they could have just pushed him out the door and said, it's not working out, Dan. So what can we take from his story?
Well, that's a good news story. And the theme that Dan brings up there about it's the best thing that's ever happened to me is one that I do hear a fair bit, actually. And you kind of correctly identify, he probably wouldn't have quit the job on his own. And so lots of times people are in that situation where they leave involuntarily. They're let go. But in the end, once they're through all those emotions, they realize I was not a right fit there. I wasn't happy there. And moving on is the best thing for me. The second point, though, it sounds like that law firm, I can't speak specifically for them, but See, one thing I really encourage employers to do is to take some sense of responsibility that maybe they've made a hiring mistake in the first place.
It's not the person, but you hire the person that's not the right for
Correct.
That job. It's not
Correct.
That they're not right for any job.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, rarely does this happen, what we're describing here. Most times it's the employer blaming the employee for not being a good performer or whatever. But the reality is that, you know, as Peter Drucker, the management guru, who's now deceased, but said, sort of, if I've hired somebody into a job and he or she does not work out, I have made the mistake. And so if more employers would take that point of view that either they hired the wrong person, they themselves rushed in the hiring processes, or they didn't sort of coach and develop that person, but assume some sense of responsibility, I think you'll see a more compassionate and empathetic approach if they do have to let that person go in the end.
Okay. Anthony's in Dartmouth with a story for us. Hi, Anthony. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that the one two before me, that one where the company, I don't know if it was the individual values of his who called the people back after 6 months or the company values, but that really says a lot. If it's a company that does that, that says a lot about their values, that they actually do appreciate people. Myself, I've never really had a problem getting employment, but recently when I went out west and came back, I've had serving experience and cooking experience and been first chefs, and I wanted to get back in the service industry. Everybody only wanted me as a cook, so I finally did get a job at a hotel, and I don't really know much about the wine list or anything. I'm more of a bar server, and they hired two of us at the same time, and after 3 weeks, we both got the email on the same day. You could see they were tagged, and I really thought they were just very impersonal because the guy that hired me seemed like a great guy. Not once did he ever have to come, you know, tell me maybe you could do this better or this better. I thought it was just a very impersonal way to go about things, especially since we seem kind of to get along on the workplace. But after that, moving on, I got a position at a hotel, and I've been in a position where I'm the witness watching people being let go, and they always say the same thing. At this time, we're moving in a different direction. And I really hated listening to people say that, because what does that mean? It's very generic. I think why they send the email out, it's kind of to cover their own butts, so it looks like if anything comes back on them, they have something to fall back on and say, here, we did everything in a professional and proper manner. But when I was working at that hotel, it was a union, and I kind of clashed with a girl that was at the same level as me. And then one night they brought me into the office and just asked how long I was here. It was before my probation, and said, at this time, we're moving in a different direction. And I just said, I kind of laughed. And I said, you know what? Has there ever been once since I've been here that you've brought me aside and asked me, like, I had to have a talk with me about this or that? He said, no, but at this time, we're moving in a different direction.
That's their story, and they were sticking to it.
And I chuckled, and I said, oh, thanks. It was great working with you. Have a good day. It doesn't hurt my mentality like it would hurt some other people, but it would have been nice for you to tell me, I don't care who's a witness to the room, but point out to what I did wrong so in my future I could actually make a mental adjustment and I don't make that same mistake at the next appointment. Because some of these people that are having these problems, you just get that generic email or the generic tone, they don't know what's happening and what they could fix on themselves, and then they go through this cycle of it's the same thing, and they don't know how to fix themselves.
What a great point. So Jerry, it is hard to learn if that's all you get. We're going in a different direction, whatever that might be.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of management speak drives me bananas. There are a lot of kind of buzzwords used, even around the words firing, like downsizing, right sizing. You know, I get kind of sick and tired of all that sort of stuff. But the point the caller raises about just an employer being honest, I mean, I have seen situations where an individual has been dismissed more than once throughout their career for the same reasons. And people are just sometimes lack awareness of how they are relating to other people, for example. And if some employer would just give them that good feedback and be honest and truthful with them, it would be very, very helpful to that individual. And the individual can then decide whether they wish to correct that situation or not.
If you know it's coming, if you've sort of can read the tea leaves, are you better off resigning or waiting until the bitter end, until you're fired?
Well, often it boils down to money in that situation, because if someone's being dismissed, they're probably going to get a severance package of some sort, depending on their years of service, where if you quit, you don't. I have seen situations where people are, some companies are doing some downsizing, but someone hasn't yet been asked to leave the organization, but they go and they offer to leave if they could take advantage of that severance package. So I think ordinarily it's better to wait. receive the severance. And of course, if they're being dismissed for financial reasons, it's not going to impair their future employability.
Right. What do fellow employees deserve to know about a firing? Because when it happens, the office mill is going to be churning. Are other employees owed an explanation so they can learn something about what the company wants?
Yeah, you raise a really good point, because lots of times employers, you know, they think about how they themselves are going to do it. And many of them are very fearful about doing it, too. I recall attending one dismissal on behalf of the employer. In the end, the employer said, I can't do it. I can't actually dismiss this person. And
why? You mean they didn't have the nerve to do it?
The nerve to do it, yeah. Okay. I mean, they liked the person. The person wasn't doing anything really bad or anything like that, but they just had to cut back. But she just couldn't bring herself to actually do it. I think somebody else did it in the end. But the communication with other employees is something that is often overlooked. And they're worried. I mean, they're upset themselves if somebody's leaving, particularly if the person's well-liked in the office. So that's problematic for the other employees, but they themselves are worried about their own employability with the organization. So I think it's important for an employer, say they had to cut, I don't know, let's say five people to pick a number, that to be able to give a message to the rest of the workforce that this kind of solves our problems now, and everybody's fine, we're going to move ahead, and try to be conscious of those concerns that people have, and frankly have an open door policy. If anybody individually wants to meet with the manager, that the manager's there to speak to them.
Some great information for employers and employees today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Great to have you here. Jerry Walsh is the founder of the executive search company Gerald Walsh Associates. Keep your stories coming. Tell us if you think there's such a thing as a good firing. Maybe you have a story that you want to share. 1-800-565-5463 is the number to reach our answering machine. And you can send an email to marnoon@cbc.ca. Well, yesterday on the program, we talked about the risks police officers and other emergency responders face when they pull over to help someone stranded on the side of the highway. On Tuesday night, a 35-year-old RCMP constable from Nova Scotia was killed in New Brunswick when he pulled over to help a motorist change a flat tire. A utility van hit his cruiser, killing Constable Francis Deschaine on the scene. I talked about the danger with Mike Spurns. He spent 33 years as a traffic officer with Halifax Police.
You could be doing everything according to our manuals, your standard operational procedures. You can be taking all of the necessary precautions, and still things can go off the rails. And inattentive driving certainly is very prevalent today. People texting, using cell phones in their vehicle, GPS. We also see people putting on lipstick, shaving, drinking coffee, and with their dog in their lap. And I can tell you that there is more danger in an officer doing traffic stops, road checks, assisting people on the side of the road than there are of armed robberies or drug dealers or responding to known dangerous situations.
Well, after the show, we received this email from Dr. David Kidd in Moncton. He writes, I am a radiologist in Moncton, but years ago trained in pathology in Ontario. Unfortunately, I saw many victims of this kind of thing. Pedestrians, people pulled over to sleep in their cars, or pulled over because of a breakdown. It happened with disturbing regularity, and it usually didn't make the news. I learned that there is no safe place on the side of the road. I'm teaching my children to, if at all possible, always get off at an exit. And if you can't, then pull over as far as you can. Always assume someone may hit you. Never stop looking at the road. Unfortunately, until all cars are self-driving, this will continue to happen. People simply get distracted. My deepest condolences to Constable Deschaine and his family. Well, our thanks to David Kidd for writing. If you have more to say about this, our answering machine is at 1-800-565-5463. Well, lots of you wanted to share more views on whether we should eliminate gender identification from IDs and forms. Yesterday, our guest wanted people to ask why it's necessary, for example, for a fishing license or for Facebook to know your gender. Felix Gilliland is with the Gender Free ID Coalition.
I think it's important to understand the history of where this documenting of gender came from. Back when a lot of these laws were formed, what was put on your birth certificate, an M or an F, actually decided like who got to vote and who got to own property, things like that. So those laws are no longer in place. So it's just, it's not relevant anymore to have these gender documents.
So after that program, we had plenty of feedback, particularly about the recent change to Canadian passports. It now allows people to identify as male, female, or just mark X. Helen Archibald emailed to say, thank you for this show. I just emailed my daughter to tell her about the change on Canadian passports. She just renewed her passport and had to put an M on it. She went to the Canadian embassy in the Netherlands dressed in her dress. No one commented. With her passport, she needs to dress as a man. She was born in Quebec, and they have made changing your gender very challenging. Well, thanks to Helen for that letter. We also received these phone calls.
Margaret Harriman, 372-5183 West. As always, normally, your program is so interesting, but I have a problem because X to me is it, and I don't want to be known as an it. I remember a transgender friend of mine in the 70s who became female, wiped out all his former teaching career when he became female because there was no record under female. But that's come a long ways. I think it should be an option on the birth certificates whether the parent wants to put down they had a boy or a girl. If they want to put X, that's fine. Bye-bye.
Hi there. This is Lindsay Bowie calling from Nova Scotia. I'm just calling about the issue regarding identification, identifying gender on our official IDs. Just listening to the callers, it just, all that those comments say to me is that we need more education in our communities and in our different generations. I think it's really important for people to understand that just because you are one way does not mean that everybody is that same way. From a data point of view, I think it's really important to have a gender on IDs because of, you know, who needs more mental health and where does the focus need to be and are these people into sports? Gender itself seems to be a major determining factor in terms of funding, in terms of research, lots of stuff like that. That being said, I don't see any reason why another gender can't just be listed as one of the options. I'm not a fan of the X. I think it's a negative connotation. I think that something else more creative can be developed or thought of. There's no reason why you couldn't have another gender, just have, you know, male, female, and something else, some other creative, you know, letter besides an X. And, you know, I'm just happy that things are going the way they're going and that people are aware. And I just hope that a push happens for it to be more inclusive for everybody. Thank you. Bye.
And thank you for those calls. Lots of activity on this question on our Facebook and Twitter account as well, where the conversation continues. This is from Carolee Eddy, who posted, I'm not sure why gender identity is so important to people, especially if they don't have any gender ID issues personally. I often wondered why that question was on so many forms I filled out. And finally, Max Janes tweeted, I think it's important to ask why we need this information. Why does Facebook care what's in my pants or brain? Thanks, everyone. If you have more to say about this, our answering machine, once again, is at 1-800-565-5463. Tweet us at CBC Maritime Noon. You can join the lively discussions we have on our Facebook page. Just look for Maritime Noon on Facebook. And the email here is marnoon@cbc.ca. Tomorrow on the program, if you left your outdoor painting project until September, lucky you, what a week you've had. It's been so warm, it's been so dry, it feels like mid-August. And there are many more good painting days to come. But before you start, call in and get advice from the expert. Our paint guy, Jim White, is back to take your calls and to set you straight. That's Friday here on Maritime Noon. Thanks for all your calls and for listening today. I'm Norma Lee McLeod. Have a great day.